Welcome to committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. This is House File 1816. It is a MnDOT technical bill. And I appreciate coming from you. Are you going to wait for a forum, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I've got two testifiers here from MnDOT who could talk about the bill. Basically, members, what this does is clean up language from previous sessions. It also does some more work on things such as truck weights and the like. It doesn't expand truck weights in a way, but rather just cleans up the language of existing law. But with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn to our two testifiers.
And if you would identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Dean Halverson. I work for MnDOT. Half of this bill is about cleaning up the truck weight statutes that have been in place for quite a number of years. In one case, it corrects a problem that we've had since the 70s. In other cases, legislature passed in the last 4 years some weights for agricultural commodities, logs, canola, and what this does is bring these weights into the chart so that it's easy to look them up. It doesn't expand the weights, it just puts them in the chart. There is a permit fee that the counties can collect, and the way the bill was written last year, it appeared that money had to go to the Trunk Highway Fund. The counties were saying, if we issue the permit for our roads, we should be retaining that fee, and that $300 fee, and that cleanup is in here. That's basically the truck weight corrections that are in there.
All right.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Erica Earhart, and I'm also from MnDOT. I'm just gloss over a few of these sections that we have in the bill. About 30 sections deal with cleanup of household goods provisions. Last year, there were some changes in the way we regulate household goods carriers in the state, making it simpler for them to get into the industry and that sort of thing. Now we've gone through and carefully cleaned up language that no longer applies to any kinds of carriers in the state. Another 7 sections of this bill deal with the language that we use to incorporate certain Code of Federal Regulations sections. There were some concerns about whether we used the proper language to do that, and we just used the words as described by the feds. 4 sections deal with USDOT numbers on trucks that are required to have a USDOT number now have to put that number on the side of their vehicle. And 1 more section deals with medical waivers. MnDOT gives medical waivers for intrastate drivers who have certain medical conditions like diabetes. Currently, there's a bar for 3 years against giving these kinds of drivers waivers if their license has been suspended, canceled, or revoked for any reason. And we're just sort of focusing the list of reasons why this could happen. This bar could be instated to certain driving-related offenses.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee? We'll just set this aside for now, and then we'll come back to it when we get a quorum. So
okay,
maybe Representative, you'd be willing to hang around a little while in case there are some questions later.
I'd be happy to thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members.
Representative Simon here. Again, we do not have a quorum yet, so I cannot move the bill yet. It's just
okay.
Like to instruct us and educate us what the bill is about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is House File 8, which is the Minnesota False Claims Act. Many of you, I think most of you here, have heard it at least once in other committees because this is its 7th committee stop. It has 1 more to go, which is the Committee on Ways and Means. I know we can't make that motion yet, but that's where it's headed. Many of you, or most of you, know this already, but the False Claims Act is a bill that exists in 22 other states, the federal government, and it provides incentives for whistleblowers who report those who knowingly, and that's the key phrase, knowingly defraud the government. And it's been very successful in other states, so successful, in fact, that the federal government has provided an incentive for states like ours to pass such an act. And they did that in 2006. And what they said is, and the reason for their interest, of course, is because of programs jointly administered by the state and the federal government, such as Medicaid. And so what they've done is they have given the following incentive. They said, state, if you pass the False Claims Act that meets four key criteria, and our bill does meet those criteria, if you do that, then we're going to give you a 20% bonus on your Medicaid fraud recoveries. And here's what that means in practical terms, members. Right now, since Medicaid is a 50-50 split, medical assistance is a 50-50 split, so too are the recoveries from any fraud prosecution. So, for example, if today Minnesota were to bring in $10 million in Medicaid fraud, $5 million of it stays here in Minnesota, $5 million of it goes to the federal government. That's the deal, because it's a 50-50 split. If we pass this law, just passing it, not even using it, if it sits on the shelf forever and is never used by a single plaintiff ever, we get a reward simply for passing it. And it's a reward that we benefit from year in and year out, as long as the law is on the books, and that's 20%. So in my hypothetical, the $5 million that we would have kept today would turn into $6 million. And the feds would keep $4 million, and we'd get to keep $6 million instead of our $5 million. And so if you look at what the average is over the last several years of the take that Minnesota has from Medicaid fraud prosecutions, that would come out to, and this is a conservative estimate, some years it could be higher and some it could be lower, about $2 million a year for the general fund, just as a bonus for passing the law, not using it, just passing it. The False Claims Act originally started under President Lincoln in the Civil War, and it was a way to get at crooked contractors who knowingly defrauded the government, as by selling cardboard paper boots and sick mules and the like to the Union Army. And since then, it's turned into what it is now. Members, that there is, since we don't have a quorum, I can't put out the amendment. So I don't know how you'd like to proceed, Mr. Chair.
Sure, maybe you could explain the amendment. So,
sure.
And then we'll look after. We must be getting close to the quorum at this moment.
Would you like me to do that?
Yes, why don't you?
Okay. The A8 amendment to House File 8 is has some substantive changes, and forgive me, members, for the late amendment here in terms of a substantive change. The reason for that is because this has been the product, as the whole bill has, of some ongoing negotiations. I've had now 19 meetings with various stakeholders. So there's been really, I think, a breathtaking amount of negotiation here. We've been in contact with the governor's office, and this amendment contains things that the governor's office says that it wants and needs in order to sign the bill. So I'm interested in signing the bill and not just making a statement, and so that's why the amendment. So let me just walk you through what it does. Lines 1.4 and 1.5 of the amendment reduce, not increase, but reduce the civil penalties in here to be exactly like the federal act. So it's total parity with the federal act. The second substantive bit is line 1.10 and 1.11, which is basically the language that folks wanted to guarantee, even though the language already says that, that there's no action for any person under this section for inadvertence or mistake. We've taken out in this amendment too, and that's line 1.9, we've taken out any provision that has any reference whatsoever to inadvertence, mistake, negligence, etc. So this act only covers those who knowingly defraud the government, and that's a very high standard. It's the same standard in all 50 states, so this is nothing new. So that's another thing that folks wanted. And then finally, Representative Holberg, in the last committee hearing in the Transportation Finance Division, brought up a really interesting and, I think, astute observation. She said, what happens, and this had to do with the Trunk Highway Fund, she said, what happens if the fund that is defrauded is a dedicated, even constitutionally dedicated fund, like the Trunk Highway Fund, what happens then? And how do we make sure that that fund recoups its losses and that it doesn't go into the general fund? So talking with her and working with House Research, and I think Mr. Shepard is here to answer specific questions, we drafted this language. It has the blessing of Representative Holberg and others. I've run it by some of you offline, and that's lines 1.14 to 1.21, which guarantees that the particular constitutionally dedicated fund, or not even constitutionally, the dedicated fund gets paid first, then it goes to the general fund. They should be made whole first. So that's what the amendment is, members.
Thank you. We're almost to quorum. So let's see if there are some questions on the amendment. On the bill itself. I don't know. I don't see anyone else here.
We're
going to have to recess for a few minutes. Okay. To visit with us about House File 1213.
Mr. Chair, I believe that it's House File 702.
Okay, 702 first?
Right.
Yes, that's right.
We have a quorum.
We now have a quorum.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would ask that somebody move House File 702, recommended pass and sent to the General Register. Mr. Chair, this bill started off...
Why don't we do that right now?
Right.
And then, I will move the Public Safety Finance Division report for House File 702 of the First Committee on Engrossment. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? And then I'll move House File 702 of the First Committee on Engrossment be recommended to pass and placed on General Register. Okay, now we're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 702 started off as a bill that cost money. One of the challenges that we have in Minnesota is we collect a lot of data regarding the juveniles within the juvenile justice system. However, it's not uniform and it's not very useful. And so we started off requiring some of this data to be collected. However, given the budget situation and the fiscal cost that came back with it, this bill just talks about the policy group to study the feasibility of collecting and reporting data that would be consistent so it would actually be usable. In the event that Minnesota does not comply with the collection of data, we have the we may lose 20% of the funding that we get regarding juvenile justice. And so we just want to make certain that we are in compliance currently, and we want to make sure we stay in compliance in the future. Mr. Chair, and that's the bill.
Thank you. Any discussion or questions from the Representative Kiffmeyer?
Thank you much, Mr. Chairman and Representative. Certainly the children's juvenile justice system, we want to make sure that it's efficient and effective. And I think my only concern is, I know we're cutting the agencies, and so anything at all that we put upon them, I just always have a caution is knowing that they already have to absorb and do other things. I just have a caution at putting other things on top of them. If the agency says they can just absorb more work like this?
Representative Hilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, yes, the agency said that the current staff that they have, they can do this. And one of the hopes is because data is already being collected and they're already doing it, we're hoping to actually streamline the process and maybe make less work and make the data more useful.
Great. Thanks.
Any other questions? Seeing none, I will move my motion that House File 702, the First Committee Engrossment, be recommended to pass and place on the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Thank you. Is Representative Morrow here yet? Okay, he's not here, so maybe we can, Simon, maybe we can. Would you like to move your bill?
I think someone needs to move the division report first.
Okay. Well, I can do that. I move the Transportation Finance Division report for House File 8, the second engrossment. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
I will vote.
Now, Mr. Chair, I move the House File 8 be recommended to pass as amended. And, well, it hasn't been amended yet, but
no.
That it be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
And then would you like to move
the amendment, which I discussed just a few minutes ago, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Any discussion on the bill itself as amended?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir. Representative Salt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, we just put the 8 amendment on, right?
Right.
I was just chatting and I had a couple questions. Couple things. Representative Simon, can you help me understand? You and I had a chance earlier in the session to talk briefly about this, but I mean, what's the goal? What's the objective of the legislation? Is it to get people in court, or is it to get money back to the state?
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is to get money back to the state.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, that's what I understood the intent to be. And I guess my question, Representative Simon, I still have a concern. You know, we've got this language that we just put on in the A8 amendment about right to cure.
Right.
Except, Representative Simon, to be honest, I don't really think that the language there is really a right to cure. Mr. Chair, I guess my question, Representative Simon, is why didn't you come forward with an amendment that provides a real right to cure? In other words, something's identified and you have 15, 30, 60, 90 days to fix it before you can commence litigation.
Right.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good question, Representative Bowles. And as I mentioned before, I've had 19 meetings with various stakeholders. I know some of them are in the room. And I have offered up various language, and I've asked others to come up with other language. But one thing that I've said, and I'll say it here again, I will not accept language on this bill that offers a so-called right to cure for those who knowingly defraud. And what we've done is go beyond that in the current right to cure. We've gone beyond that and said there is no, can be no, liability at all for negligence, inadvertence, and mistake. And that goes beyond the right to cure. That's even further. And members, the example that many of you have heard me now in multiple committees make, but I think is an apt one, is the example of shoplifting. Now, disclaimer here, I'm not comparing some of the folks in the room to shoplifters, but I think the analogy is a good one nonetheless. And that is, if I go to a Best Buy store and I take 5 iPods, knowingly, I stick them in my bag and I walk out to my car and security catches up with me in the car, I don't get to say, you know what, you go your way, I go mine, it's a right to cure, I made a mistake, here are the iPods, I'll be on my way, let's just forget this ever happened. We don't get to do that. I do get to do that if I'm in the store with a 4-year-old and the 4-year-old, unbeknownst to me, puts it in my bag and then I'm busted at my car. Then I probably do get to say, this was a mistake, I didn't do this knowingly. But I'm not going to accept any language, and nor would any other state in the country accept any language, nor is there any language, that allows people who knowingly, and that's what this bill is about, the word knowingly, which is defined in a way that's recognizable in all 50 states, those who knowingly defraud, they don't get a do-over, and I'm not going to accept that language. And I told the advocates, some of whom are in this room, that, and I've offered them, if they don't like this language, to come up with language, and they failed to do so.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, thank you. I haven't had a chance to roll up my sleeves on this, and maybe I will between now and the floor. But I guess where your analogy strikes me as coming a little bit short is that, you know, you're talking about criminal liability as opposed to civil liability, which is what your bill's about.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the only way, if I'm representing an individual who wants to bring a claim under this,
sure.
Or let me change that. If I'm defending somebody who is having a claim brought against him or her or a business entity, whatever the case may be,
right.
And in fact, it was inadvertent or mistake, and I can prove that, or I think I can prove that, or I have evidence suggesting that, I still have to go through the litigation process in order to prove that, number one, and number two, as I read your bill, there is an opportunity for attorney's fees and costs and other things, not just if somebody prevails, but if a settlement is reached. And so I guess my concern, Representative Simon, is that if my client did in fact do something inadvertently or by mistake, the only way to establish that, if I'm sued, is by taking something all the way through trial. And, you know, maybe that's your intent, but again, if the goal is to recover monies for the state as opposed to enriching others, that's my concern. I'm not exactly sure how to address it. I think that we should, we can move this thing out of here today. I think I know what's going to happen on the vote, so we'll move it out of here today. But let me ask one more question. I'll flag that concern. I'll talk with you some more about it offline, Representative Simon. And like I said, I haven't had a chance to roll up my sleeves on this, and I'll try to do so between now and the floor. Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, I have been shown a preliminary fiscal note on the last bill, the companion bill, over in the Senate, and it shows a cost of about $2 million. And I'm wondering, do we have a final fiscal note, and why isn't it in our packets if we do, and where's this being accounted for in the budget?
Mr. Chair, that's a mouthful. I'd like to address, if I could, Representative Coles, your first comment that you flagged, and let me tell you how we come with that. Section 12 of the bill contains what has to be the strongest pro-defendant attorney fee provision, not pro-plaintiff, pro-defendant attorney fee provision in the country. And I'm convinced that it is probably one of the strongest such provisions in Minnesota law if we were to pass it. Pro-defendant, not pro-plaintiff. And what this says, and it's extraordinary, and you know, Representative Coles, from your time around here and your time as an attorney, that this is an extraordinary measure. It says that if the defendant prevails in the action, the court shall, not may, shall award attorney's fees and expenses to the defendant. So it's not discretionary if there's a finding that the action was frivolous, clearly frivolous, vexatious, or, and this is the best part from the standpoint of a wrongly accused defendant, or brought, and this is the amendment, I'm sorry, it's not in the bill now, it's in the amendment on line 1.12 of the amendment. Instead of solely, it now says in substantial part. So for there to be an attorney fee award, you don't have to show as a defendant that the person brought it solely for harassment. You only have to show that it was in substantial part, which could be less than the majority. A judge could find, you know, this person brought it, 35% of the reason they brought this was to harass. 65% was because they sought a claim, and a judge could say, you know, 35% is substantial. And so you get attorney's fees. That is extraordinary. And that was an extraordinary concession on our part. I'm happy to answer the fiscal
comment. And Representative Simon, I do appreciate that. The issue, though, as you know, Representative Simon, is that a lawsuit can be brought when there is evidence to support it. Obviously, an attorney has an obligation to not commence litigation without evidence to do so. And a defendant very well may feel as though it has sufficient evidence to win at trial. But it may be facing a 2 or 3 week or 2 or 3 month trial with all kinds of expert witnesses, and it may do a cost-benefit analysis that, you know what, it doesn't make sense to move forward with incurring $100,000 of litigation expenses to ultimately prevail. I can settle by paying the state 20 and attorney fees of 60 or 80. I'm not sure that that's justice. And that's, I guess, Representative Simon, where my concern is. I recognize the work that's been done in Section 12 there. I do think that you're right. If a defendant does make it all the way through and prevails at trial, that word shall is a significant, that's significant. But my concern remains that, you know, you know how the litigation system works. You've represented clients on both sides, Representative Simon. Clients make decisions in litigation sometimes for reasons other than a principled reason, other than wanting to actually see their claim finally adjudicated. And that's the concern that I still have. But you and I can talk further about this offline. If you would address the fiscal issue, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Coles. I will. And I'm happy to work with you and any of the stakeholders. I'm happy to have that 20th meeting. I've had 19 now. We're getting into to fill in the teams. I'm happy to go over and have the 20th meeting or the 30th. So my door is always open. Let me talk about the fiscal note. The reason you don't see one before you is it's been pulled, apparently, for revision and revision downward, and that's because in the Transportation Finance Division, just the other day, we determined that MnDOT had made a mistake, and they've been very gracious about it. I think there was just a misunderstanding on their part about what this bill did or what it didn't do, and so the liaison from MnDOT just whispered in my ear literally today before the committee that when the fiscal note comes back, it will be revised downward from MnDOT's perspective to show a $20,000 gain to MnDOT instead of a cost. There were two other agencies in here that had something on the fiscal note, and I think, Representative Cole, if you're looking, I don't know if it's the most recent version, but it very well may be. And
There was a cost from the Department of Human Services. We had extensive testimony on that in the Department of, in Representative Huntley's committee. And then there was a large fiscal notice you saw from the Attorney General's office, and we had extensive testimony on that in Representative Kahn's committee as well. So those have already been addressed. This, by the way, members, is also House File 8, or the substance of it, has been folded into Representative Kahn's omnibus bill. So it was passed off the House floor, so it's alive here as a standalone and there as well.
President Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Representative Simon, just to make sure I understand that, so the Attorney General costs are within Representative Kahn's budget bill. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Accounted for there?
That's correct.
Just a final comment, Mr. Chair. Representative Simon, given the likely fate of Representative Kahn's bill, I think your wife is moving House File 8 on its own.
Hi, Mr. Chair, I'd like to hedge my bet. That's all.
Representative Claude.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm going to go into non-lawyer world for a moment after listening to you two lawyers speak for a little while. Representative Simon, it was very entertaining, as always. Representative Simon, I'm trying to understand if there was any changes between Health and Finance, where we discussed some of the issues related to encouraging people to go through their own internal process before leaping outside of that process and sidestepping any internal management issues. I think sometimes I get concerned when we encourage people to go outside of a structure that they might have internally. I think it kind of creates a managerial environment which is difficult and could encourage all sorts of things to occur down the road. But has there been any changes related to that from Health Finance now?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Broad. Yes, and you had brought up that point when we were in Representative Huntley's committee. The main change that was made substantively since then is to get rid of about one-eighth of the bill that pertained to those who were the beneficiaries of negligence, inadvertence, accident, but who knowingly failed to report. We got rid of that. So now there's no mention whatsoever in the bill of any inadvertence, negligence. It's only knowing behavior, and that's defined elsewhere. But as to your specific issue, we have not taken up, as we did not that day, this idea of reporting within any reporting mechanism. And one of the reasons for that is the whistleblowers aren't always employees, and so that wouldn't necessarily get at, I think, what the issue is that you raised. In other words, they usually are, but they may not be employees. As long as they're an independent source as defined in the law, they could be a whistleblower under the suit. So I appreciate the issue that you're raising, but no, we've not made any change in that specific respect.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Simon, I believe the language, the way it was written, said that if there is an internal process or if there is a department within an organization, whether it's a hospital or a nursing home, then the process would have to flow through that department or that part of the organization. And so I think it still is something that I hope that you'll consider in that 21st meeting after Representative Cole. it just seems to me that we ought to encourage organizations to take care of some things themselves if possible. And when you create an organizational environment or a culture within an organization that is deceptive even more than the one that I suppose that you're suggesting is already occurring, I guess I would have some concerns about what we might be doing internally in terms of the meddling between employers and employees. But secondly, I'm wondering about the other issue that I raised related to the word knowingly. I'm not an attorney, but I look at subdivision 3 and I'm trying to understand the knowingly and knowing definition. And the other issue that I brought out in Health Finance was I might knowingly have input a code if I'm part of use nursing home. Knowingly input the code or coded something a certain way because that's how I was told to do it. Or that's how I learned to do it. But I didn't knowingly know that it was wrong. And so I'm trying to understand how this relates to that specific issue related to... It's hard to walk through
it. Yes, Representative Senator. I think I understand, Representative Broad. And yes, that's something that comes up frequently. People say, well, does knowingly mean exactly what you said? Did I knowingly type the code? No, it rises above that. And if you look at the cases that have been litigated under the Federal False Claims Act and under the various state False Claims Act, that's clear.
That's a very good question. In other words, does knowingly just mean knowingly doing the act without more substantive knowledge? And the answer is no. But that's a fair question.
Okay. And just one last point. You represent a Simon. I appreciate that, and I know that you're a good attorney. I knowingly know that. And the part that concerns me a little bit is on 1.20, and I know this is part of the federal language, but the idea that no proof of specific intent to defraud is required tells me that there's a loophole there that a smart attorney would be able to find that would not be me. But it just seems to me that if you don't have to prove intent, that you knowingly did something, there seems like there's a conflict there that I'm just not able to work out in my head.
Representative Feynman.
Mr. Chair, thanks, Representative Broad. And this has come up in other committees as well. This is part of the federal language that we're tracking. And it doesn't say that there isn't proof of intent. It's specific intent. And as Representative Coles knows, that's a term of art, specific intent. And the way it was described to me in law school in my first year was this. If I, and I won't use your name this time, Representative Kiffmeyer, which I accidentally did last time, if a person goes and shoots into a crowd, knowingly, not accidentally discharged, shoots into a crowd and kills Susie, that person has done so knowingly because they've done so in reckless disregard that harm would come to Susie. He or she, the person, he didn't target Susie, he wanted to kill someone in the crowd, as sick as that is. That is knowingly and without specific intent. If someone goes to the crowd, goes up to Susie, and shoots Susie, having targeted Susie, that is specific intent. So specific intent is a term of art, and it just means here that a person is still liable for reckless disregard, as in the first hypothetical, but that's enough. You need not prove that the person intended to go up to Susie herself. That's the best analogy I can come up with. That's the way that term was taught to me in law school.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one more question. Using that interpretation, it's pretty easy when you talk about shooting into a crowd. I get that. But how about for the situation that I was talking about, a medical miscoding? Is there a scenario that you can walk through related to that? Because I think it's very different than shooting into a crowd. I think that makes a lot of logical sense. I'm just trying to understand the specific intent around a miscoding.
Sure. Let me think. A specific example would be this, and I can take it from a real case. In Illinois, for example, and this is one of the handouts in the committee, where there was a health company that was knowingly enrolling dummy or ghost enrollees that didn't exist. These people didn't exist. They were fake names, fake people, and then they were collecting on that. They might not have had specific intent to defraud this or that particular agency, whether it's a county or whether it's a city or a state or even another private company, but there was the knowing intent there to defraud. They might not have targeted one particular entity, but they might have just said, hey, here's a scheme by which whoever's paying us is going to pay us more. That's the best analogy I can come up with.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Simon. It's mainly just a comment. I mean, I see some of the issues, but especially under the right to cure, I think it's a question that I have. Is the focus of this bill to correct or to punish? Because I think most of us as regular citizens would say we just want to correct most of the time rather than punishing. And I think then the other question I have is restitution versus incurring lots and lots of court costs. I mean, I think if the court's having really critical things to deal with, so I just don't want to give them that job if we can avoid it. And so I'd be more focused on correction and restitution than punishing and incurring court costs, just because I think it's more in the public good. That's why I'm sympathetic to the other kind of right to cure.
Mr. Chair, and that's a fair point, a fair philosophical point. I think it's some of both. It's mostly to recover, but it is also, I think, in some respect, to punish. Just like the person who steals, in my analogy, from shoplifting. We don't let them say, hey, here's your stuff back, no harm, no foul. We do prosecute them. And so it's the same thing, and that too takes up court and public resources, but we've made the decision as a society that we're not going to let folks just say, hey, here are your iPods back. There's going to be something more that we ask of that person to pay to society for having done that act, even though the victim, in this case, the Best Buy store, is no worse off for having a tripod stack. So it's a philosophical decision, and I hope that we've gotten to the right blend and balance here.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Fenn, I think that is a very fair kind of analogy, though usually we have at least the three strikes and you're out, and that there are some opportunities there to make those corrections. So maybe there might be a blend of the two somewhere along the way. Yes, thank you.
Any other discussion or questions for the committee? Hearing none, Representative Simon removes his motion that House File 8 be recommended to pass and we refer to the committee and waive the means. All those in favor say aye.
Yes. Aye.
As amended. You say aye.
Aye. Aye.
And those opposed?
No.
Motion passes. Representative Ma, maybe we can move your bill now. We've already heard it. Yeah, I will. I will move House File 1814, the Transportation Finance Division Report for House File 1816, excuse me, in the first committee in growth. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
We have one more here. Two more. I will move Senate File 1876, the unofficial endorsement be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. Oh, do I just go on with the next one too? And then one more. I move to delete the language from Senate File 1876 and refer to the language from House File 1816, the first committee engrossment on that one. Any discussion on that? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Okay, then I renew my motion to vote on this one, right? Senate File 1876, the unofficial endorsement be recommended to pass and place in general register. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Vote. I don't know if I need that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you. Representative Hortman here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Horton, I will move House File 1213, the first engrossment, to be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. Representative Horton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is really a pretty technical bill, and we had heard it in Representative Paymark's committee, and it was, I believe, laid over there because we weren't sure, or we sent it there. And we heard it in Deborah Hilson's committee. We weren't sure if there's a fiscal note, and we've determined there is no fiscal note. But what the bill does is it makes two definitions of prostitution parallel in statute, the posting prostitution in a place of public accommodation and the other kind of prostitution. And that's really, I think, all it does. Is there something I'm missing?
No, welcome to the committee. If you introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Melissa Reed, Intergovernmental Relations with the City of Minneapolis. And Representative Portman is correct. Most of the bill is fairly technical. Just cleaning up the definition of misdemeanor prostitution and gross misdemeanor prostitution. Currently, the offenses are just described differently in law. For some reason, the elements of the offense are described differently. So we made those definitions parallel. We put in a definition for a place of public accommodation. Currently, the statute references a place of public accommodation but doesn't actually provide a definition. So we provided a definition that's taken from civil rights law, so that's already an existing law as well. And then Section 3 just cleans up a loophole in existing law. We think it was actually probably a drafting error. The way that the law is currently drafted, if your first strike for prostitution is misdemeanor and your second strike is misdemeanor, the second offense is enhanced to a gross misdemeanor. If your first strike, however, was a gross and your second strike is a misdemeanor, it's not enhanceable under current law. So again, we do think that that was probably an initial drafting error, that certainly if a first strike for misdemeanor can enhance the second strike, then if the first strike is a gross, it should certainly be able to enhance the second strike that's a misdemeanor. And that's pretty much the entirety of the bill.
Any discussion or questions from the committee? Hearing none, and I renew my motion that House File 1213, the first congressionally recommended to pass and place in general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tamar. We're doing 1270 first, I think. Would you like to move your...
Chair, can I do 1505,
okay.
Since I have my witness with me?
Committee, we're waiting for copies of that bill.
Great. Here it comes right now. I can do the other one quickly. That's fine. Mr. Chair, I move House File 1270.
All right, Representative Paymeyer moves the Public Finance, Safety and Finance Division report for House File 1270, the first engrossment. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Move opposed. Representative Paymeyer.
Chair members, this is a very...
Do you need to move the House File now again?
I would move House File 1270.
The first engrossment be recommended to pass and place in general register. Representative
Kamar. This bill just sets up a process for the Commissioner of Corrections to develop a pilot project for detention and supervision of persons committed to the Commissioner of Corrections. As you know, in the public safety bill, we have gotten rid of the short-term offender program because it was costly to counties. The state was not paying enough, so the whole program is being settled this year. But we do know that some of our county facilities do have vacancies. Maybe that's not the right word, but have room available. let me try that again. So if they do have. They do have room available, and what we're trying to get at here is these are the short-term offenders who might have a probation violation, who have done something wrong while they're on probation, so rather than sending them to prison for a very short period of time, that they would go to a revocation center where they could get programming and treatment. And this is patterned after a program in Montana that's been quite successful. We think it's going to save the county and the state money. I have a correspondence from the Department of Corrections that this will not cost the department any money.
Representative Seymour, you have a testifier?
No.
I'm on the next one.
So unless there's questions, I renew my motion.
Any questions or discussions from the committee? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed.
And then, Mr. Chair, I would move the Public Safety Finance Division report to House File 1505, the first engrossment.
President Tamar has been informed that we do not have a sufficient copy yet. They're on the machine. They'll be here. Why don't you move forward and explain the bill?
Okay, we don't have it. Okay, the committee has the bill, apparently?
Not yet.
Okay, the committee doesn't have it. I'll explain the bill.
Yeah, there are a few out there.
Okay. Sorry about that. This is... 1505 is a bill that deals with sex trafficking, and this is a huge problem in the United States, and it's also a significant problem in the state of Minnesota. And it's not the victims of sex traffickers are not limited to being foreign-born individuals. Many Minnesotans, young girls and boys, are trafficked in the state. You might remember back a couple of years ago where a trafficker had some young women in an apartment, and it was quoted in the paper that the women were each, quote, servicing 30 men a night. These are trafficked girls and trafficked women. So what we've tried to do here with, what we're attempting to do here with this bill is we're creating a new provision that's patterned after the first and second degree assault and criminal sexual conduct statutes. So there would be a first degree trafficking and a second degree trafficking. So the first degree would deal with children under the age of 18 and repeat offenders. Second degree would and second degree would be a victim over the age of 18. And we've also added sex trafficking as one of the crimes in the crime of violence statute. And then the final thing we've done is that there is a provision in statute now on employer retaliation that prohibits an employer from retaliating against a victim who wants to be in court to testify if they're a victim of crime, and that unfortunately in statute now being a victim of a sex crime is not included in that statute, so we're correcting that. So with me is Mary Ellison with the Advocates for Human Rights, and if you have any specific questions, she'd be she could probably respond to those.
Representative Paymeyer, I think we now have copies of the bill, so maybe you, before we do that, you would move the bill. We can vote on it.
Then, Mr. Chair, I would move House File 1505.
Representative Paymeyer moves Public Safety Finance Division Report in House File 1505, the first engrossment and discussion. Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed. And Representative Paymeyer, if you move it again.
Did I move the division report just now? Is that what I did?
Yes.
Okay. Now I'll move the bill, House File 1505.
Representative Paymeyer moves House File 1505, the first engrossment. We recommend it to pass and place in general register. And I understand there's an amendment, A10, but why don't you go forward with... Welcome, committee, as you introduce yourself for the record.
Sure, before we begin, did we say second engrossment is the
first?
First. Okay.
First.
Mr. Chair, my name is Mary Ellison. I'm a staff attorney with the Advocates for Human Rights. And the Advocates for Human Rights published a report on sex trafficking in Minnesota in the fall of 2008. That was a study that was commissioned by the Department of Public Safety. We presented that report to the statewide human trafficking task force. There were over 80 recommendations in that report for strengthening Minnesota's response to sex trafficking. Several of the recommendations had to do with strengthening our Minnesota law so that we actually can convict traffickers of the crime of sex trafficking. And we have worked with a coalition of individuals as well as the statewide human trafficking task force to put together the language of this bill. The task force is made up of 21 member organizations. We've also consulted with more than 30 individuals who are experienced in law enforcement, prosecutors, judges, and service providers to come up with this bill. It is strengthening the law on sex trafficking that was enacted by this legislature in 2005, and we believe that it will provide an excellent tool for law enforcement and prosecutors. We've had the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association testify at previous hearings. They have agreed with us and supported our bill, and we would like to move forward with this bill. As you may know, it doesn't have a fiscal impact in this biennium, and we believe, and the prosecutors have told us, that this bill will strengthen their ability to convict sex traffickers. We have not had convictions for the specific crime of sex trafficking in Minnesota. There have been some convictions under the promotion of prostitution statute for cases that are factually similar, however, not for sex trafficking. We need to really deal seriously with this issue in Minnesota, and this bill will allow us to do that.
Thank you. Representative Colts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Tamar, I first let me say I absolutely support your bill. I want to see us figure out how to get this done. The question, though, that I have is, you know, you were very clear throughout the session that, you know, you weren't going to allow people to come forward with bills that enhance penalties and, you know, created new penalties. That's essentially what we're doing here. We're expanding the definition, and so Ms. Ellis indicated there was no fiscal impact. I'm just curious how that can be. If to the extent there is a fiscal impact, Representative Paymar, I think we should figure out a way to pay for this. I agree with it completely. I want to see it get done. But can you help me understand, there's not a fiscal note in our packet showing no fiscal cost. So help, I'm guessing there is one, and can you just explain that to me?
Representative Paymar. Mr. Chair, if some calls, the fiscal note that we have, we can make copies available to the committee, but the long-term, there was no short-term fiscal considerations for this coming biennium, and then it says the provision of this bill will result in the need for one prison bed in fiscal year 14 at the cost of $12,000. The projected bed impact will increase to three beds by fiscal year 23 and each subsequent year with annual cost of $58,000. So, Mr. Chair and Rick Nichols, I think I'm being consistent with my own policy, I guess, that the committee adopted, saying that if there were going to be increased penalties, if they had an immediate bed impact in the coming biennium. So that's what I'm going on. I hope that's okay.
Mr. Chair.
I've been informed that there is a fiscal note in your packet for this bill. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just took a peek at it, and Representative Paymar, I appreciate that. I'm glad to see there is no fiscal impact in the near term. I guess I'm a little surprised to see that the bed impact is limited, or, you know, it's projected to be three beds. I hope that's the reality. If it's not, you know, I hope we figure out a way to deal with whoever is out there, you know, trafficking individuals for sex. You know, if it's three or if it's 300, we got to find a way to put these people where they belong, and it's not out on the streets where they can be harming, you know, harming the community, harming not only the women that that they're trafficking, but it just sort of tears at the social fabric, and it's just such an awful thing. So I'm surprised, to be honest, that it's only three beds. I really hope that's the reality. I hope that this isn't as bad. I suspect that there's more out there than just three individuals, but however many there are, Representative Paymar, we need to find a way to get them off the street.
Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, maybe Ms. Ellison could quickly respond. She knows more about this than I do.
Mr. Chair and Representative Coles, we have the same hope that you do. One of the reasons that we think that the bed impact was reported to be so low is that, in essence, in many ways, what we're doing is we're exchanging one felony for another. So right now, some prosecutors are charging under the Promotion of Prostitution statute, or they may charge under things like kidnapping or criminal sexual conduct. So we think that that is why the bed impact is likely so low.
Any other questions? Representative Pearson, you have an amendment to A-10.
I have an A-10 amendment that I would like to move my A-10 amendment to be added to this bill.
Representative Champion moves to amend House File 1505, the first committee engrossment. Would you like to discuss your amendment, please?
This amendment is a part of a bill that I carried on behalf of the department, and what it clearly does is just that this is that the commissioner now is slated or required to gather and compile information annually, and this is done every year. All of the advocates as well as the department thought that it was better if that information could be compiled and made available every 3 years, but to be consistent with the Senate language, we are looking at it being compiled and available every 2 years. Now, that isn't to say that the information will not be available if someone called and asked. It would still be available, but the report will be required to be submitted every 2 years. And I believe this is also okay with the author of the bill.
Any discussion? Representative Pima?
It's a good amendment. We should put it on.
Any discussion questions concerning the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? And we move to the bill as amended. Representative Paymar, any final comments? Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Thank you. Yeah, Representative Thiessen. You have House File 804. Would you like to move your bill?
Yeah, I'll move that House File 804 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register.
Representative Thiessen moves House File 804, the first engrossment, to be recommended to pass and place in the General Register. Do you have an amendment?
Move the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Thiessen moves the A1 amendment. Would you like to...
Actually, instead of the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair, I'd just like to delete Section 4 of the bill.
All right.
If that's all right.
Representative Thiessen moves them to delete Section 4 of the bill.
Which is what the A1 amendment was intending. So.
All right. Any discussion or questions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay, Representative Thiessen, if you will.
This is a bill related to guardianships and conservatorships, and it does a couple of things. It creates a bill of rights in Section 5, which is largely rights that exist in a full variety of places in statute and just collects them in one place. And we've worked very hard to kind of work out a balance, and I think there's general agreement now on how these rights lay out. It also is aimed at bringing some more transparency, some more eyes to be looking at these guardianships and conservatorships to make sure that people are aware of what's going on and can watch over them a little more closely. We've had some news reports recently about some issues surrounding guardianships and conservatorships, and it also improve. I think there's some process improvements within the bill that will make things, make sure that when we set these guardianships and conservatorships up, they work the way they're supposed to work. And we've worked very hard with all the interested parties to come to a resolution that everybody, I think, can live with. And so I'll just answer questions.
Any questions?
Trying to recall some of the circumstances we've read about lately, that there's some sort of an accounting or report to someone that's in the bill here, that so there would be some oversight. I think that was one of the problems, at least with one of the cases reported in the media.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, there is some additional required accounting, and the accounting has to now, under this bill, go to more people as well.
Yeah, that's essentially my question.
Yes. Thank you.
Any other questions or discussion? Representative Cole.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, or maybe Representative Carlson, why are we here in finance?
Representative Thiessen.
Mr. Chair, at one point there was fiscal notes because of pieces that were in the bill, but that referred to finance.
And they've been dropped?
They've been dropped, yes.
Thanks, Representative Thiessen.
Any other discussion?
There are a number of bills that are coming through that way. In the past, and there will be in the future, where once we were sent to division, the fiscal part was dropped for a variety of reasons, probably not the least of which is resources.
Any other discussion? Seeing none, Representative Thiessen, then we move here. There's a motion to House File 804 as amended. The first engrossment be recommended to pass and placed in the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed.
Thank you.
Representative Carlson, did you have an opportunity to read the minutes for April 29th?
I move their approval.
Any discussion? All those in favor of the minutes for April 29th, 2009, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? I think that completes the work from the committee. It is now adjourned.